I'm Amber Love of Vodka O'Clock Podcast from AmberUnmasked.com. Today my special guest is Alan Kistler. This episode is sponsored by Audible.com. For a free trial of audiobooks, go to audible.com/AmberUnmasked. Alan Kistler, welcome to the show.
Hello.
So one of the reasons that I have wanted to have Alan on the show as a guest is because when we met, it was sort of like fate that he was talking about what he does and asked me what I do, and he said that he has a column about superhero fashion, and I just about died right there in the bar. So, yeah, I mean, costumes are obviously one of the things that I spend a lot of time researching, so I went and checked out Agents of Style, and whenever there's something new and exciting, some new costume that a character gets, I'd love to get Alan's take on it. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about was the basically like a look at the history of the cat suit or the spy suit, because it's a very common superhero, anti-hero style, and the new Batman movie is obviously going to be coming out soon, so Catwoman's in it, and she's probably the most iconic of the cat suit, as well as other spies that are out there. But then we will also get into learning about Alan's book projects for 2012. So, Alan, let's get into this. Welcome aboard, and give a little maybe background as to how you got into talking about fashion in the first place.
You know, it's one of those things where I realized I was kind of always into it. I just didn't realize I was into it, because I used to sketch all the time. And looking back in junior high, high school, I constantly did these drawings that at the time I called comparison pieces, where I would draw the same superhero about five times, wearing five different costumes that he'd worn over the years, or if they'd had transformations of some sort. I would have them all there, basically the same pose, just for comparison pieces, and looking, and just to show myself, okay, here they all are together. What do I like? What works? What doesn't? And it was just, you know, me being geeky and nerdy. And, you know, fast forward several years, and I'm doing web videos and articles and all, and I happen to meet Tim Gunn at a signing. And jokingly, I asked him things such as, well, is there a superhero you really want to redesign, or what do you think about superhero fashion in general? And to my pleasant surprise, he actually had really nicely thought out comments for it, and we got into this little banter. And I just thought to myself, man, wouldn't it be fun if we just did a whole video just on this? So I asked him. He said, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. We did a two-part video. And
They were so much fun. They were great.
Yeah, it was great. It led to other videos later. And in the meantime, I saw that there was an audience for this. And at the suggestion of someone else, started the Agent of Style column. And it was kind of on a trial basis at first with Newsarama. It's like, because people generally thought, okay, this was huge, but can you have a sustainable column like this? Do people really care that much about the chronological history of costumes and the evolution of it for superheroes and villains? I mean, come on, no one cares that much, surely. And after the fourth or third piece I did, I got emails, okay, we need to make this a weekly column, because holy crap, people love it. Like, even people who hate it are reading it and need to see more of it. Like, holy crap. So, yeah, we just went into that. And I'd been doing articles for years on the evolution of superheroes and the evolution of fiction, because that's really my forte, is looking at how certain characters and stories we might take for granted developed over decades and over different creators and pop culture and different mediums. So it wasn't that big a shift, really, to just then turn that into a focus on the visual aspect. And it's very fun, and it makes me rethink certain things every time I do a piece where, you know, I'll in the past have dismissed some, well, that was weird for 2 years or something, and I'll have to go back, and to make the column good, I can't just say, yeah, this was stupid, let's move on. I look at it, and I say, okay, what made this stupid to me, or what made this silly to me, what made this not work, and does it not work because I think it's bad, or does it not work because I think it would work, but for a different character?
Well, I think it does come down to character on such an important level, but yet at the same time, comics are visual, movies are visual. So,
of course,
when a character changes a costume, like let's take, you know, putting Wonder Woman in pants after all these years. Wonder Woman's had a ton of costumes.
Yeah.
But when that change hit, it was, you know, they may as well have just said, you know, nope, Wonder Woman's a man from now on. Like, I mean, they really, it was such a drastic hot debate.
Yeah.
Whether to put her in pants or not. And yet, you know, plenty of people see the gladiator outfits and they like those. And it's like, okay, well, here, she's not wearing the bathing suit thing in this, and everybody likes this, but talk about pants on her, and it's just, like, the most ridiculous argument.
It was so funny to me because about 6 months before the storyline you're talking about, where they gave her the streetwear and they gave her those black trousers.
Oh, yeah. I hated the jacket. I mean, I really did have oppositions to certain things. I had oppositions
to the
armor, the jacket, and the colors. I didn't like that they did either. But, I mean, but I don't think it was the fact that, oh, she's in pants. That didn't bother me.
No, I agree with that. And
like, let her have a wardrobe.
Yeah. And I think certain creators have dealt with that very nicely. George Perez and Phil Jimenez. I mean, Phil Jimenez especially just had so much fun indicating that Wonder Woman has a different wardrobe, where she would wear this outfit when she's speaking at the White House, and then she would wear this outfit when she's, you know, attending some press event. She would wear this outfit for when she's attending the Justice League meeting, and then she'd wear one of the Linda Carter jumpsuits for when she was riding on her motorcycle to visit a fan, and I loved that. But what I was saying, like, about 6 months before this whole black trousers, leather jacket thing happened, I had done a video where I went around asking people, do you think Wonder Woman should get trousers? And I spoke to many, many people, and I found that women in general were against it in the idea that they didn't want someone, say, toning down her femininity.
Right.
And Emma Caulfield, wonderful actress from Timer and Once Upon a Time and
Once
all.
Once Upon a Time, right.
Yeah, she gave a great response where she was saying that it's not so much, you know, just about is it a fashion choice, but that she objects to a woman character, a female character, being dressed more as a guy to be taken seriously as a professional in whatever they're doing. And I completely understand and agree with that, and I've talked about it with Tim Gunn, where he was bringing up how on Capitol Hill they were hiring female interns but hadn't gotten a new uniform for them. Like, it wasn't just that they were wearing the same uniform but with a female cut. They were wearing literally the same uniform, so they were wearing men's clothes.
Oh, okay.
And that's absurd. If you wanted to make it a suit coat and suit pants in a female cut, that would make sense to me.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's another thing where I think people do sometimes forget trousers can be modeled for women. So I don't... I think with the
spandex look as well, it's pretty much just a colored naked figure.
Yeah. Well, that's superheroes in general. They're all these nude Romanesque figures with details put on them.
Yeah. And it actually bothers me sometimes, especially, I don't know why, but Spider-Woman in particular is painted as, like, a naked body all the time. Like, you can see her nipples, I don't know why this one character, I think it's the realism behind Alex Maleev's work and stuff, but these artists sometimes have no concept of fabric.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's always funny to me when, and again, I get that it's supposed to be a skin-tight outfit, but the skin-tight outfit doesn't, you know, women wearing skin-tight outfits, it usually doesn't contour completely to their breasts.
Right.
And nor should I be able to see a belly button.
Right.
There are little details where, even for superhero comics, I get so annoyed when I see pictures of Phoenix or Spider-Woman and I can see the belly button, because I'm like, well, who really made this outfit? What is this actually made of?
Yeah, the only thing that people have argued with me is if it was one of the Lantern Corps, because their outfits are made out of constructs. I'm like, okay, well, that means that that Lantern in particular is choosing to be naked and colored by light.
Right. And even then, I would possibly argue with that. Because if he's just thinking, I need a suit, then he or she is probably thinking of, what do they think of as suits? They think of cloth.
Yeah.
They think of familiar materials and that forms around them. I would be surprised if any of them were really thinking, ring, make me pretty much naked, but with light and with nothing showing my junk.
Yeah. Which, you know, this is a good segue into the catsuit discussion, because they are these very tight, typically black, full-length unitards,
mm-hmm,
in a variety of fabrics these days, because you know, sometimes it looks like something spandex that's just meant to be sleek to crawl in and out of windows to steal jewelry or whatever, or some, you know, something like that, versus something leather, motorcycle leathers that just happen to be skin tight, which is not how I think a motorcycle rider would actually be, but that's how they're shown. You know, and then we have these cool spy suits where you just sort of throw your imagination up to the wind and say, okay, well, this, you know, this is some amazing near bulletproof type Kevlar with all sorts of pouches and pockets and things.
Yeah, I mean, it's they've been around really since the 1940s. And can be both men and women, but in our modern times, when we say catsuit, we tend to think of women. And, I mean, they've gone around for, like, practical needs, such as, you know, dancing and aerobics, to high fashion items here and there. You'll see them on runways.
I was going to ask you if it ever worked its way into actual ready-to-wear or... if it was just a couture type thing.
No, it's definitely, I mean, ready to wear is sort of a different form of fashion that implies, you know, more of a versatility to the outfit as opposed to you're putting
right
on a show.
Right. And I think it's pretty much restricted to athletics, as you said.
Right. And I mean, if this is on a runway, it's high fashion. It is meant to make a statement. It is meant to say, wow, where did she get that outfit? Or, you know, how did she get that body? It is a certain kind of fashion. And it definitely came into popularity thanks to the Avengers British television show.
Right.
Because, I mean, people say Emma Peel, but even before her, there was the character Kathy Gale.
Right. There were other companions to Steed, which I only just learned about a couple weeks ago, because there's a new Steed and Mrs. Peel comic coming out.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and I researched a little on Mrs. Peel, and and I was completely shocked to see that she wasn't the only sidekick, if you will.
No, I mean, Steed had really a rotating cast of partners at first, and then the first catsuit wearing woman who was also very, very tough as a woman and as a woman protagonist was the Kathy Gale character, and then she left and Emma Peel replaced her. But Emma Peel's the one that most people know and most people talk about.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the 60s were a great time for fashion. So when we moved into the mod fashion in the 60s, I think it was... pretty common to see things like zip-up jumpsuits. I mean, they weren't necessarily skin tight because they had bell bottoms or bell sleeves or something like that. But for the most part, they were there were a lot of form-fitting clothes then. And I think of, besides Mrs. Peel, I think of characters like Agent 99, who had a great wardrobe. But I couldn't recall if 99 ever did wear a catsuit.
I believe 99 did wear a catsuit in a couple of episodes. And, I mean, one of the cool things about the catsuit, the way that they were using it and the way the Avengers used it, is that there was actually a practical reason for it as well, because, I mean, they had a leather catsuit in the Avengers. And that was for the simple reason of it doesn't split during an action scene. And it looks well, and it looks great in studio lighting.
And have they always been black?
They tend to be. I mean, there have been different sort of cat suits. In Doctor Who in the 1960s, one of his companions, Zoe, wore this very reflective silver cat suit. Which frankly looked pretty cool in the black and white era of Doctor Who. It was an interesting take on it. And then it took a while to work its way into comics. Because at this time, even though Catwoman on the 60s TV show was wearing cat suits, the Catwoman in the comic books really wasn't. She started wearing tighter clothing. And
right, she had that really great dress for a while.
Right. Right. She had this long purple gown, basically.
Right, with this cloak over top.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, and they did turn that into a shirt and trousers look very briefly, and then they dropped that. And after the TV show, she got this weird green. I mean, it looked more like a jumpsuit than a cat suit. It wasn't quite form fitting in the right ways. And frankly, it was bizarre to have it be green because I don't know of any cats that are green.
Yeah, no, cats are green, and you know she's still supposed to be a cat burglar.
Yeah,
so you know it makes sense for a character like her or the black cat to be wearing black because they're
right.
supposed to be sneaky and stealth.
Right.
As opposed to, you know, if it's a unitard that just happens to be in a variant color.
Yeah, and with Catwoman, it also depends on which era you're going for that it makes sense. Because the fact is, I mean, she's originally a jewel thief, and then in the 50s and 60s, she was more of a gang leader. Where she was committing crimes, but it was sort of like how the Penguin committed crimes in those days. She had a bunch of people, often dressed as cats or with cat-themed names, committing crimes for her, and she led these crimes. And she doesn't become really a solo cat burglar again until the 80s, and that's when we get the jumpsuit, or the cat suit, rather. And that's when we get back to really form-fitting clothing. And that's just been her look in many different ways ever since then.
And who was the artist that first gave our Catwoman, Selina Kyle, that tight suit?
It really happened in Batman Year One with David Mazzucchelli.
Okay. Because I know one of the popular ones is the purple suit by
right.
Chip Ailey that actually has a tail, which I don't
right.
believe anybody else ever gave her.
There was one brief similar costume in, I want to say, 89 in a backup story where she did wear a purple outfit and it seemed to have a tail. There was also a gray version, the Year One outfit where it was a gray cat suit. There was a version of it that did have a tail in Catwoman Year One. But it never really struck people, the tail edition. It always seemed
right.
kind of unnecessary.
Well, I think it was strange because for Catwoman, one of her tools is a whip. So the whip worked as the analog for a tail.
Yeah.
Whereas not, you know, other cat burglars perhaps didn't have that. They might have had grappling guns or something. So when it comes to Selina, knowing that she has the whip, the tail part just seems so unnecessary.
Yeah, and in the cartoon series The Batman, which you and I have both talked about it at length here and there, they did a beautiful job of any time she had the whip back at her side, it did become a tail.
Yeah, yep. And that's one of my favorite suits, in fact. And when I see people cosplay as in that particular version, I get so excited because it's, I mean, well, Bruce Timm is just so genius anyway, and there are times when, like I said, a costume change comes through and I'm just like, oh my god, what were they thinking?
Sure.
But I liked that she, until season 4, they made her completely black, and I didn't like it. It's like, I really liked what they had done with that gray suit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. And, Catwoman's such a fun character, and part of the fun, and this goes back to what we were saying in terms of dressing up for the character, she is sexy. She is supposed to be sexy, and she's right. very aware of her sexual power.
Right, so, like Black Cat. It's not always that way, just because you put the suit on.
Right, right. So the suit makes complete sense for that character. Especially in later years, when you got Darwin Cook making the more modern suit, that's a leather, literal cat suit and has the zipper down. It made sense for there to be a zipper there, frankly, because then you get these fun little scenes where Selena's trying to get information or trying to convince someone to let her do something, and she just can zip down her top a little bit.
Right.
And never too far, because Selena never actually gives you what you want. She just likes to tease you.
Right.
But it made sense for that character to do that and to have a suit that would let her do that.
I agree. And how do you feel about fan response when there is the infamous Catwoman Batman scene in the New 52 where they're having sex in this penthouse, and the arguments that people got into about her suit, about not only is she's constantly losing her suit in every single issue, which really is getting tiring.
Yeah.
But in that particular scene, people were just like, her suit doesn't possibly unzip that far. It's like, it's art. I mean...
Yeah, if that's your criticism, perhaps you are focusing on the wrong thing. I didn't like the scene myself. I had my reasons for not liking the scene. It had nothing to do with fashion. And also, it does not offend my life or destroy any part of my appreciation for the character. That scene exists. You know, there's so many comics with the characters we love, and now and then there's a comic where I don't like a scene, or I don't like the story.
Sure.
And I didn't like that one. And I move on with my damn life. And hope that the next writer, or the next issue even, will be better. I didn't care for that scene, mainly because it seemed out of place to me, and I was more... I more didn't care for it because of Batman's reactions and behavior in the scene. Not because of Selena's.
Haven't they always had some kind of history, though? They've always had some sort of sexual history.
No, absolutely. And under other circumstances, you know, I'm not against them having sex. Absolutely not.
Oh, okay. It was just you didn't like the way that played out.
Right. It was how the scene happened. It was not the fact that they were having sex. I really don't care about Batwoman and Catwoman. I mean, Batman and... Batwoman and Catwoman would be a whole different thing, wouldn't it?
it would work.
Oh, yeah. No, that would sell some issues. But, and Batman and Catwoman have dated, and they've flat out told you have consummated in the past. So this is not like some new idea that they would do that. It was more like just a couple of elements. The fact that Batman initially protests and Selena goes anyway. The way they did it made it seem slightly forced to me, which just made me personally a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And not that they were implying that, but that's just how it came off. And I also thought that it stood out to me because already in this issue, I had seen a few pages of Selena basically running around naked, then going to a strip club, then remembering a form of sexual or a form of physical abuse when she was a hooker. And so, like, it seemed like you were packing in as many sexual situations as possible into one issue.
Right.
So that's really why it bothered me. It had nothing to do with, well, zippers don't work. Oh, shut up. Like, honestly, Batman's mask should not work either. He should not be able to turn his head. Whatever. This is, as much as I enjoy talking about practicality of costumes, as much as I do believe we should look at what makes sense for the character, it's not a movie. It's not a television show. This is a comic book medium. And in the comic book medium, it's an exaggerated reality. And fabric will sometimes do what we damn well tell it to do. There's a reason Superman's cape never just flies into his face. You know, the wind just never seems to be moving in that direction.
Right. And, you know, capes, we'll have to have a whole nother show just about capes. Do you have a favorite cat suit in particular, whether it's from Selena's Catwoman or somebody else in history? Do you have one that you say, yes, this worked for every single reason, and it's right on this person and in this situation?
You know, I loved the classic Black Widow suit. The black cat suit that she has with the gold belt.
With the circle belt?
Ooh. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I just kind of love it. It's...
She was also gray for a while, wasn't she?
Yeah, yeah. She, in the 80s, they turned it into a gray suit with a ridiculous pop collar and this giant spider on the back and no belt. So I was just wondering, where is she keeping all this equipment that she seems to keep pulling out? Yeah, it was a very strange suit to me, even though it was the first suit I saw her in. And her original costume was really just fishnets and a corset with a cape. And then she changed it to the cat suit after seeing Spider-Man, actually. And she was already on her way to trying to reinvigorate her life and find a new direction in life. And like many of us, she figured a new look will help enhance your new direction, kind of puts you in a new mindset. She saw Spider-Man, saw, hey, this guy's able to do all these acrobatics in a skin-tight outfit. Obviously, I need to follow suit. And I always thought that was kind of cute, that, like, Spider-Man, who she didn't really know that well, would just inspire her costume change. But I deeply love that cat suit. And with Catwoman, I actually really love the Darwyn Cook redesign. Though I do have a great fondness for the purple Broadway gown with the green cape that we talked about. There's just...
Yeah, that's a beautiful look. It makes no sense to be crawling through windows in it.
Right, which again, you can only use that if you're portraying Catwoman as a gang leader. If you're portraying her as a cat thief, I mean, she wore it for a couple of issues in the 80s where she was swinging across rooftops with Batman, trying to be another partner to him. And it made no sense then. Why are you running across rooftops in heels and a ball and this ballroom gown and a cape? There's so much volume of fabric right now. You are going to get in trouble. But it's just sexy and classy and very, very fun.
So what's your prediction of the sale of Halloween costumes this year? Do you think that Marvel's Black Widow, who's, you know, by Scarlett Johansson, which looked awesome. Do you think she will outsell the Anne Hathaway Catwoman?
You know, I think so. Just because Anne Hathaway, one, Catwoman is almost so familiar to people. It doesn't have the same kind of sexy new jazz to it. It's
a little tired.
Yeah, for some people it can be a little tired, and then also it immediately invites comparison for people who don't read comics, because there's also the Halle Berry costume, which was terrible.
And yet sells like hotcakes.
Yet sells like hotcakes because it shows off skin.
Yeah.
And there's also the Michelle Pfeiffer outfit, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And you know, everything about it is violence and sexual power. And so if you put on the Anne Hathaway outfit, no matter what party you go to, there's going to be someone who says, oh, you should have worn the Michelle Pfeiffer outfit or something. It invites comparison, and everyone's going to have a different idea. You know, some people, even if they like Anne Hathaway in the movie, will say, well, I still like the Michelle Pfeiffer outfit.
Right.
Or the Eartha Kitt outfit, or whatever. There are just so many versions of this that I think it's going to deaden that sale. Whereas Black Widow, as far as the non-comic book reading public are concerned, there's really one look for her. And she impressed a lot of people in the Avengers movie. A lot of people really dug her and were surprised with her, especially if they'd seen Iron Man 2, where she's basically a replaceable character.
Right.
And I think that's really going to hit. And I mean, especially just with the money you spend on Avengers alone, the money they've made, rather, worldwide. I mean, it's a couple $1 billion at this point, I think. And, you know, if one in every 1,000 of those people takes a Catwoman, a Black Widow suit, that's huge.
Yeah. I think they did a great job with interpreting her. I'm not as thrilled with this new Dark Knight Returns Catwoman style. I mean, it's okay. It's great. It certainly looks fabulous on her. I know that Nolan tries to bring things more believability with, you know, like, it looks like her mask is more of a visor, but it looks clunky and chunky, and I don't dig the thigh-high boots, unless you're just saying, okay, well, she's riding a motorcycle through, you know, parts of the movie, so she needs extra protection. But, again, clearly, unless you've done some drag, men, or pirate gear, you've never worn thigh-high boots, you don't realize how uncomfortable those damn things are, especially with the stupid stilettos.
Right.
Those stilettos are just the most ridiculous things I've seen. It's like they're these pointy metal things, and that's what they focused on for the Catwoman movie poster, was her heel.
Yeah. Yeah, it's...
I mean, it's better than her ass, but still.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, I hate the poster where it's just like, look, I have a butt.
Yeah.
I hate those. Same thing with superhero covers, where they're doing the simultaneously, look, I have breasts and an ass.
At the same time,
you
know, yeah.
Just in case you weren't aware of anatomy, here they are, and I possibly have broken my spine, but the point is, I look good.
Right.
Yeah, I hate those stuff. But I'm honestly... And I'm looking forward to the movie, and there's only so much we can predict and tell from a couple of trailers. But I am honestly surprised that they didn't go with the Darwyn Cook ultra-realistic, frankly, for a comic book Catwoman outfit. Because just because Nolan's universe is so ultra-realistic, this is not a universe where superhuman powers exist. You know, this is not a place where even necessarily the Lazarus Pit exists. This is so grounded in reality. Catwoman seems a departure for that, from what I've seen, with the heels and essentially a Mardi Gras mask. I was really expecting goggles that imply cat ears and simple
boots.
That's
what I thought, too. I just figured that there would be, you know, I'm not sure which artist, if it was Darwyn or whoever, you know, came up with that first, but there was the, you know, the... Like you said, she has, like, a backpack, and she has these goggles, and they do point upward, which goggles can certainly be practical, and, you know, even in a Nolanverse, they could be infrared or changed to different things, you know, who knows? I mean, if she's got money at her disposal, they could, you know, have an x-ray setting, have an infrared setting, have a heat sensor setting.
Sure.
and then, you know... Biker Amber, you know, so it's, I'm not sure about the tactical look to what they've done, and it's like, you can't be tactical and stick her in these stupid shoes at the same time.
Yeah, it's a very odd choice. I mean, I'll watch the movie, obviously, still, but it's a very odd choice, and I really can't say it's the look I would have gone for if I was directing or involved in this film at all. I would have completely gone for Darwyn Cook. It's easy, it's Catwoman, it's realistic.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you there. So let's move on to talking about your books, because you've got several, we've got one out now and two on the way, I guess,
right,
as far as official releases go. So you did the unofficial Hunger Games cookbook, is that correct?
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones cookbook,
yeah.
Okay.
The same publisher has done a Hunger Games cookbook.
Okay. I swear I saw it somewhere, and I was like, oh, well, that must be Alan's book. okay, so why did you do a Game of Thrones cookbook? Because as somebody who, I couldn't get through the first episode of this show, I don't understand the hype about it. Is food a focus on this show?
In the show, not so much.
Like, the Hunger Games one, I think, would be funny, because you'd be doing things, you know, like, you know, wild game roadkill or something. But
right.
What, you know, I don't know anything about Game of Thrones.
Well, I mean, Game of Thrones, for anyone who hasn't watched the show or seen the books, I mean, I won't spoil anything for you majorly, but it essentially takes place on an alternate Earth where it seems to be very much like medieval Europe. But there are a couple differences. For one thing, there are certain creatures that exist there that do not exist in our world. There are dire wolves, which are like wolves, but the size of a horse, and seasons last for years. And I mean, it's basically inspired by The War of the Roses, but put into a slightly fantasy setting. So this book series has been going on for over 20 years now. Mm-hmm. And 5 books are out, 2 more are supposed to come out. The show has been, the first season was based on the first book, this season was mostly based on the second book, and the next 2 seasons will be based on the third, and it will go on in a similar fashion. So, I mean, the show, you do see them, of course, eating and drinking here and there, but that's just part of the scenery. In the books, anytime food happens, anytime food is present, before the scene goes on, the food is described. And they'll go into, you know, not just, and Sansa had a salad, it'll be like Sansa had a salad with fennels and cherry tomatoes, and it had orange peels on the side, and next to it was a dish of lemon cakes with honeydew sprinkled on it, followed by a mead from Dorne that had, you know, and it, he goes into specific detail on several of these. And it, for people who love the books, it's part of the whole thing that creates the atmosphere of the story. It really just helps lend to the idea of, you know, what they're experiencing, you know what they're doing. And so many people have talked about trying to recreate recipes here and there. And there was a website that was also doing the same thing. I deliberately didn't look at it until, you know, all of my book was done and the final edits were in or anything, because I didn't want to even accidentally be influenced by it. But yeah.
So then, how did you just toil away in your kitchen, or did you actually just consult with professional chefs on, you know, what they would do, and then?
Oh yeah, definitely. You know? I've had the fortune. I'm not a professional chef. I mean, I cook, because you can't go out and eat every night. It gets expensive. But I'm not a professional chef. But I've had the fortune of knowing about 3 professional chefs in my life. And with this publisher, basically, it wasn't just a matter of, hey, I can do this, okay, go write it. I had to basically audition. So I did a sampler of about 6 recipes and showed them how I would present it, what the recipes were, what they were based on. The other thing is that these are not recipes of, like, this might be what they were eating. Every single recipe has some connection to a meal or a scene in the books. And in each recipe, I give a little introduction telling you where you can find this in the books, what book and chapter. And I give a pretty non-spoilery account of, you know, the emotional significance of this food or of the scene that it's in, blah, blah, blah. So I went through all 5 books and marked down every single instance of food. And for many of them, it was pretty easy, because it's like, well, he tells us the ingredients for all this salad, so
right.
What the hell? And some of them, it's something like, well, this guy mentioned a leg of lamb. Okay. There honestly are just a few basic ways to cook leg of lamb, and the rest is personal preference about spices and such. So, you know, you just kind of take it from there, and there was a lot of research involved. I spent a couple of months going through different ways of preparing different foods and figuring out, well, what works for our audience, what works for this. One thing that I determined from the beginning was that this would be very non-professional cook-friendly.
You know? Okay, I think that's helpful, because
yeah.
I've read some cookbooks, and, you know, and I've tackled some recipes that took me all day to make one dessert or something, and
yeah.
That's just, you know, they're fun to read, but, you know, for the most part, your average person is not going to do that.
Right, and some of these do take a while.
As opposed to sticking a roast in the oven. I mean, you
right.
know, there it's done, and, you know, or in a crock pot, some slow cooker thing.
Right,
but
at the same time, these are, I try to keep them very simple as recipes, which is sadly invited some criticism as, oh, this is generic. And no, it's not generic, it's simplistic. It's user-friendly.
You know, I think if you're going to do a party night, a Game of Thrones party night or something, or Game of Thrones, you know, Halloween party, whatever you're doing, I think it would definitely be the biggest element to making that happen. Because, how you know, you might not be able to decorate your apartment like a medieval castle, but you can provide some sort of food. And you can obviously, costuming is a huge part of that show. But, you know, there's bottled meads available.
Yeah.
At least it would give you the idea, like, okay, I didn't have 8 months to prepare my own mead. So.
Right. Although, like, for the adventurous types, there are recipes in there for making your own ales and an IPA. I thought it would be fun is if you were able to make a different drink for the various different houses and families in the stories. And also we took all the poisons and turned those into mixed drinks. And so again, this was meant to be pretty easy, pretty fun. The most exotic thing I called for, I think, is, you know, goose eggs.
I was going to ask you if in their world, if they have things like, you know, if they feast on something that's a supernatural animal or something that we don't really have.
Right.
Did you actually make substitutions or did you just skip over that?
Oh, no. We made substitutions. I mean, they feast on Auroch in a couple of scenes. Now, Aurochs are extinct. But venison works as a substitution for that. You know, it's a similar creature. Why not? And likewise, there are also dietary substitutions, if you wish. There are vegetarian dishes. There are, in various notes in certain recipes, if you're concerned about fat content or salt content, whatever, we offer substitutions that can help you out with that. This was meant to be fun and really meant, like, there's a giant in one book who has a scene involving vegetables. So we put his name down and said, well, here's his giant salad. You know, this is meant to be very, very geeky and kooky. And part of the reason for that is because, from what I understood from the official cookbook that was being based on the website that I mentioned earlier, they were going for a very... they are professional chefs, and were going for a very accurate... to medieval cooking, as well as accurate to exactly what was said in the books. And that's very, very cool, and I totally applaud that. It does, I think, it's taking itself very seriously in that way, so I decided, okay, well, I'm going to be an alternate. I'm going to be kind of the sillier kind of guy who's just like, hey, make your own beer, and here's a dessert you can come up with.
Right. I've actually been doing that a lot with, creating my own cocktail mixes and trying to find the right theme for them to be in as well. I've been brainstorming about that. And so, like, last week I came up with a Star Wars Princess Leia's gold bikini-inspired martini drink. And I just,
nice.
I just filmed myself making that and put it up on YouTube yesterday.
Excellent.
And... you know, and it's one of those things where, you know, no, it's not mentioned in Star Wars, but I just managed to create a drink that's, you know, takes several ingredients and is a beautiful golden color. So I was like, this is what I think of. So, yeah, it's, you know, there's, but then there are, you know, like the blue milk that they drink in
right.
Star Wars. It's like, okay, other than getting milk and adding food coloring, I don't know what kind of milk you're talking about
right.
here.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I dig the show, I dig the books. It's like, hey, let's do this, this will be fun.
So have you met anybody from the show in your Comic-Con trips and adventures?
Yeah, actually, I have. I've run into Christian Nairn. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing his name. He's a Northern Irish actor who plays Hodor in the series, who's this kind of gentle giant who always says Hodor. Whatever you're saying, just like, Hodor, can you get that, you know, spigot? Hodor. Hodor, can you bring over the food? Hodor. Hodor, are you hungry? Hodor. And he's just ridiculously sweet in real life as well as a character. And I actually showed him the book, and he thought it was very cool, and we took a photo together.
That's cool. That's cool. And you've been incredibly busy since that cookbook came out.
Yes.
And you have two new books on the way, and it's
actually they just came out.
Oh, they just came out. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, sweet. I wasn't sure what your release date was. So I was going to say we have the unofficial Spider-Man Trivia Challenge and Batman Trivia Challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know how you were planning on marketing these, by if you were going to have them come out separately, like get the Spider-Man book out in time for the new Spider-Man movie and the Batman in time for the Batman movie, but you put them out at the same time. Was that your decision, or was that the publisher?
That was the publisher's decision, and I was completely fine with it. There's already hype enough for both movies that I really didn't think it's going to matter a week if you're going to buy both books anyway. You know,
sure.
If you already plan to buy both these books, why separate them?
Other than, you know, the fact that, like, one is DC and one is Marvel, I mean,
you
can... I think it's easier for you as an author to say you're going to go do signings someplace and, you know, have as much available as possible.
Right.
Did you get any feedback from DC or Marvel about these?
Not in general. I mean, I actually gave...
I mean, I know you know a lot of people that work there, but just not, you know, corporate feedback.
Right. I haven't gotten any corporate feedback. I did give a copy of the Batman Trivia Challenge to Jim Lee and to Jeff Johns.
Okay. And I know good friends with Dan Slott, too, right?
Right, right. I have not been able to get Dan his Spider-Man copy yet, but I have it for him.
Okay.
So next time we meet up, I will give it to him. And but yeah, I mean, Jim Lee immediately made a joke to me about unofficial, I see, but... He thought it was cute and it was fun, and he and Jeff both started actually quizzing me, asking questions from it.
should be good. The other way.
Yeah, they're good guys. They're good guys.
They are.
So yeah. So I mean, it's and actually, I did show it to a couple of people in DC's marketing department, and they thought it was cool.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, the fact that you've stamped it unofficial. Was that was legally required?
Yeah, it's if you're going to mention a character, you really want to make it clear the guys who make this character or who own this character are not involved with me. So you put unofficial on the top, and then just to make it super super clear, we've got the little copy in the corner of the cover. Hey, Warner Brothers has nothing to do with this. This company has nothing to do with this. They didn't authorize it. They didn't license it. They're not making money off this.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And you should make that clear, and that this is just done as fan love. And DC and Marvel are kind of cool with that.
That's good. Because one of the things that I noticed was the Batman trivia book has a couple bat symbols in it. But other than that, there's no artwork of those characters. You've got spider webs throughout the Spider-Man one. You've got, you know, word balloon type graphics.
Right.
But you did get a couple bat logos in there.
Well,
was that okay?
The bat logos are careful because though they are similar to the official Batman logos, they are not the same.
Okay.
They're extra wingtips.
I was trying to count that, and I didn't know if it was just... There's so many different versions of it.
Right.
I wasn't, you know, my geek foo was not up on that. I was just like, well, that might be right for some version I don't know about.
No, it's that shape and that many wingtips is not an official Batman logo.
Okay.
If it was a slightly different shape and that many wingtips, or if the wingtips were drawn in a slightly different way, then we could be in trouble. But we're kind of in the same safe area where, like, Vampirella has a bat symbol very similar to Batman Beyond.
Yeah, she does.
But it's not quite the same. So, on top of DC not really caring, because you're a vampire, what else is going to be your symbol?
Yeah.
No one's in trouble. And it's the same thing here.
Well, Vampirella was around first.
Yeah. But on top of that, it's just, you know, it's the same here. They have better things to do than try to say, like, how dare he have a similar symbol in a book that is showing geeky fan love to our character and offering free advertising for many of our products.
But wasn't there... That's the way I look at it, and yet there are these... Maybe it's just hype or backlash or rage, but things that come out, and it wasn't that long ago for when artists were worried they would never be able to draw another Marvel character in Artist Alley. And Marvel came back. It was because of the Ghost Rider situation. But Marvel came back and said, no, you know, if you've worked on our books at any time, you can certainly do it. And basically they said, if you've never worked on our books, we're just kind of look the other way unless it becomes a problem. Like
right.
putting out T-shirts is obviously different than doing a convention sketch.
Yeah.
And so they, I think, you know, Marvel took the high road there and said, no, look, we're not going to be douchebags about this. But then there was a, like, robot convention, I think it was up in the Northeast, maybe Boston area or something, and Hasbro flat out said, nobody is allowed to draw a Transformer at that show.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it does come up to certain companies, and the fact is, it kind of helps that comic books are not the financial juggernaut that a toy company is,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they can use some free advertising, some free press. If an artist in Artist Alley sells a Ghost Rider drawing that really looks great, or a Batwoman drawing that really looks great, and it makes someone who doesn't know that character say, I didn't know there was a Batwoman, that's good for them. Hasbro is this huge, big, you know, behemoth that wants to sell toys and only wants to sell their toys. And screw you if you might take away attention from that. I mean, certain corporations also have such different takes on what is good for their company or what is advertising and what is taking away attention. I mean, I've done lists when certain movies have come out. I can't say which ones, but For many comic book movies that have come out, I tend to do a, hey, here's a recommended reading list. If mm-hmm. this movie looks interesting to you, here are some comics that you can get familiar with this character, or these villains, or whoever. And a couple of times, I've understood behind the scenes that an editor has been told by the production company of that film, could you not put up that list? Because you're taking attention away from our movie by telling people to read the comic instead.
Wow, that's pretty insulting, considering the source material.
Right, right. And that's how, you know, a movie production company will think of something as opposed to a comic book production company or a publisher. You know, where the publisher is like, yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, as you said, selling 100,000 copies of a comic is not going to come close to a hundred... million-dollar movie or whatever.
Of course not.
It's, you know.
Of course not. But, I mean, it's, you know, no Hollywood producer, not necessarily producers, but a lot of the guys who are in the financial departments don't like you saying, oh, this might take away 2% of sales, or 5.5%.
Instead of saying that it's, you know, they're going to complement each other. Nobody's saying, don't see the movie. They're
right.
saying, see the movie and do this. And
right.
spend your money here so that
right.
different sides of the corporation are making money.
You know, Denny O'Neill, this is years ago, in the 90s. I want to say 95. Might have been 94. But there was the time when they were finally, for the first time, for Batman's official costume, removing the outer boxers from the outfit. And he was just going to have these straight trousers.
Mm-hmm.
And Denny O'Neill made the announcement and even did a radio interview at one point saying, yeah, we're losing the boxer short look and he's just going to have these straight trousers. And this is honestly the biggest change to the standard Batman costume since the 60s, where he added a yellow circle around his logo. And he said this later, a couple people said this later, Warner Brothers apparently... called him up and said, could you not do that because we have, I think the new Batman movie was coming out, and they were saying, like, you're stealing our thunder. Because we want people in the news, when they talk about Batman, to be talking about this, not to be talking about a costume change in the comics.
Oh, that's so, so silly.
It's absolutely silly.
When most of us, you know, from a reading perspective, when we see it like, you know, Superman losing his red underwear at this point in the comics, and everybody's just speculating, well, sure, they're making a new Superman movie, and they're not giving him red underwear.
Yeah.
So, you know, to us, from the consumer point, we're going, well, the comics are only doing it because they're being forced to do it, because the movie's coming out.
Right.
But you're saying that the movie people and the comic people might not even talk to each other.
No, sometimes, I mean, I hear other things about miscommunications between Disney and Marvel. And sometimes it honestly is just a miscommunication. I know that at one point on some Marvel website, some Disney guy went in and corrected references to Thor's hammer Mjolnir as the Mjolnir. He or she added a "the" because it was a weapon, so they figured, well, you got to call it "the." And Marvel had to basically point out, thank you for being attentive, but that's actually wrong.
Yeah.
It's the hammer, but its name is Mjolnir.
Yes, like in Tolkien, the swords are all named.
Right, like in general fantasy fiction, weapons are named.
Yeah.
And, you know, whoever this was who did the corrections never thought of that, possibly has never read fiction in their life, you know. And just like, oh. And so it had to be corrected again.
Yeah, Disney is, it's obviously, I guess it's a good partnership for some reasons, but it seemed alarming when they came into the picture.
Well, everyone's always afraid of you know, giant corporation taking ownership of something they see as a little more personal. And I think those are valid concerns. At the same time, you know, the superhero industry of Marvel has not suddenly evaporated.
Right.
Nor has it suddenly become really tame.
Yeah, I think people were terrified that it was going to be, you know, that the Punisher's guns would be replaced by walkie-talkies.
right, exactly, yeah. Or that even the cartoons would follow suit. And Avengers, Earth's Mightiest Heroes, has actually been a really great cartoon. And it's really, although they eliminated the presence of Nazis in World War II, the violence has not really been held back. They've been very upfront with death and danger in their atmosphere. They just had a fantastic episode with the Vision, and him basically willing to sacrifice what he considers life for the sake of this new burgeoning humanity he's discovered. And I think that's great.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty smart cartoon.
Yeah, sadly it's being canceled.
And then it's being canceled, but being substituted, replaced by something else. But you've got these trivia books on Batman and Spider-Man, which are two of the biggest characters on the planet.
Yes.
I mean, people in third world countries, I think, know who Batman and Spider-Man are, and even Superman. So can you say what your next project is? Are you going to stick with another trivia book? Are you going a different direction? Or what are you allowed to tell us?
It is. I am working on another book. We are talking to a couple possible publishers right now. And by we, I mean my agent, who is a ninja as an agent. She's awesome. It is not a trivia book. It is an actual book. Not really fiction, but in the vein of, say, Super Gods by Grant Morrison, it would be me really putting in my own spin, my own thoughts on a certain character and topic. So that's one major project happening right now. I'm also working on scripting a web miniseries, which I can't talk too much about, but it's going to focus on a female protagonist. What else am I working on? I'm working on a feature script, but that's going to take a while. And that also has a female protagonist, because I really haven't seen a good physically kicking ass woman in television for a while now who isn't also extremely damaged.
Okay.
Since are really...
You, you're looking for, like, regular, like, major television as opposed to... You said one was a web series already, so you're going to... You're doing two different...
Right, I'm doing a web miniseries, which the initial idea was focusing on this female protagonist, though now I've also added... it's basically there are three characters. Two are women, one is a guy. And no, there is no sexual, romantic...
Triangle.
None of that happens. That really doesn't come into play in the story. But then also I'm working on this feature script, and it's going to be a movie, but it was essentially inspired by me just looking and saying, where are the non-damaged heroes? What happened to... I mean, Buffy had issues...
Buffy had a lot of issues.
Absolutely. And I'm not saying heroes shouldn't have issues. But there's a certain point where I'm just like, this person is really damaged. As much as I love Starbuck and Battlestar Galactica, this woman was never going to have a normal human relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Ever. And also was part of an ensemble.
Right.
You know, I would like to see the star be a really... physically kicking ass woman again. I'm seeing a lot of strong female characters in television and in some films, but I haven't seen like one who can also physically kick your ass, other than maybe Black Widow. But even her, she's part of an ensemble, and we really don't know a lot about her based on the movie.
Well, I think it depends on what kind of shows you're watching. I mean, if you're talking sure. about things with supernatural elements to it, like superpowers, I think it's going to be more common to see a female kick ass. But in the dramas that we have, you've got, you know, I think of, like, Captain Janeway, I don't recall ever kicking ass, but was extraordinarily powerful and dignified and was everything that a female character needed to be.
Oh, yeah.
And then you've got the, you know, Kate Beckett from Castle, who literally can tear you apart with just her thumb or something, you know.
And I love Beckett. I love Beckett so much. I think she's awesome. I think she is so sexy with her wit and her strength. At the same time, the show is called Castle.
It is called Castle, and yeah, it became the Beckett show this season, I felt.
Yeah.
It really did. I was like, yep, they got to change the name.
And this is not to you know, dismiss any of those. I definitely love those characters in those shows. It just occurred to me that, you know, since Alias was done, I've been hard-pressed to think of women who can physically kick ass and who are the star. Rosalian Isles is definitely...
Yeah, Rosalian Isles is great. I've been watching Covert Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
And I like what they do with her because in season one, she goes through this learning curve. She's fresh off the farm from, you know, FBI training or CIA training. And, like, she makes so many mistakes, and she gets her ass handed to her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just think that the Annie character has a really lovely, believable development in season one. And she's supposed to kick ass, but yet it's not all that she does.
Right.
Like her missions are... go in, retrieve this file sometimes, you know, it has nothing to do with physical brawl.
Right. And nor should, if you do have a physically kicking ass woman, nor do I think that should be the only aspect to them. I mean, it's one thing that I think has hurt development of a Wonder Woman movie or TV series is people argue, okay, should she be, you know, this sensitive teacher, or should she be this, you know, awesome warrior who's... And I'm like, she can be both. You can have moods. You can have different aspects to your character.
And I don't think they treat Wonder Woman that way, and it's one of the reasons that I dropped her. I dropped the title. Mm-hmm. And it was why I got really pissed when the Lantern War was happening, and as the token female, they made Wonder Woman the Star Sapphire.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Dan DiDio can get up and lecture about, you know, Wonder Woman being the symbol of compassion all he wants, and I don't believe it, because I'm like, is that all she is? She's the pacifist? Why don't you just ask her to take notes again? You know. and it just, it really, really bothered me. It's like, okay, you've had to undo all, you know, make her pay for all this Maxwell Lord thing, the one time she does something violent but honest. And they made her, they undid all of that. And then I was just like, and the Star Sapphires are obviously not tame.
Yeah.
By any means. I mean, they're still considered bad guys, which is funny. But it just felt so token. Like, oh, she's the female, and we've already got an idea for Hawkgirl. So.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that Greg Rucka did a good job with the miniseries where that occurred. But I do agree, like, making her a Star Sapphire, it just seemed very obvious, because it means, like, well, she's a woman, and all the Star Sapphires seem to be women. I honestly, like, when I was thinking about it, thought she should have been given hope.
Yeah. Yeah, I could have fit her into so many other colors.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But but yeah, I mean, my point being just, you know, there seems to be this, I think we're starting to slowly get out of it. But in television films, there seem to be three types of women when it comes to an action film. There's the really cute, sweet girl, oftentimes a tech girl.
Right.
There is the warrior woman, i.e. gunfighter, i.e. Mossad agent, whatever, who is incredibly intimidating and good at her job, doesn't always get humor. And then there's the sex kitten, who is very much advertising her sexual prowess and or power, and is not taken seriously, but then on occasion gives this gem of wisdom.
Yeah.
It just seems like there's these three types. Again, this is a generalization.
It's a generalization, but that's why we have books like Birds of Prey, where people fit into that role.
Right. And again, it's you know, in comics, it's, as much as flack as we give comics, I do think they do a better job of showing multifaceted women in a lot of titles than sometimes television and movies do.
So the notion of you writing a web series I find intriguing, because I know it has, it's sort of like satellite radio. It doesn't have the same, I don't want to say structure, but it doesn't have the same necessarily legalities.
Right.
As writing, you know, pitching something for broadcast TV. So, with your series, I don't know how far along you are, but how involved are you going to be? Are you going to just turn it over to an internet company to make, or are you going to be the, like, Felicia Day and have your hands in every single aspect, you know, like helping with casting and helping fit, you know, the directing and all that?
Oh yeah, no, I've written this. It's a mini-series. One thing I've been wanting to do is, rather than make, say, one web series that can last seasons, I've been focusing on a couple of web mini-series, just because I want to show variety in what I like and what I can write. So this is a web mini-series. I'm looking at it as about three episodes, maybe 15 minutes each. And I will be involved in casting. I will be involved in directing to a degree. I have a crew and a couple of cinematographers who I think are fantastic. And because of the way this story is being told, where different viewpoints are being involved, I'm using two different director and cinematographers that I've worked with before, so that each viewpoint will actually look different and have a different atmosphere. But ultimately, I'm the one who's going to say if this works for me or not.
Okay.
Because this is my story.
Okay. What sort of like rating do you consider?
I tend to go with PG-13.
Okay.
Not because of any, you know, moral standpoint. I just think it has the best availability. Then I like to be very widespread.
Yeah, I think that's the probably the biggest that you could expect of a target audience.
Yeah, you know, I also have, you know, frankly, young cousins who I adore and who some of them I would like to see watch a story like this. And so I want to be able to tell their mother, yeah, we curse like these two times, but no one's naked and no one gets their head blown off.
Okay, I think that's fair, and I think that's a great path to, especially, you know, to launch that particular part of the Alan Kistler brand.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this year is going to be focused, along with the book I'm working on, I'm trying to put out more of my fiction stuff out there. So we've got the web series, and I've been scripting a radio play. God knows how we're going to, when we finally get that done together. But again, I'm going to be largely directing. I'm going to be directing parts of that. I'm also going to be in it, and I do think you need to step away and let other people direct you if you're going to be more than just a cameo. So that's going to be happening. And I'm also working on a webcomic right now. And we'll see what happens. And the webcomic is an all-ages thing. I do have an idea for a webcomic that was very... It was darker and more adult. But I decided I wanted to go an all-ages route just because I really haven't seen all-ages stories get a lot of attention recently. And there are some great ones out there.
There are. They just need to be found.
Yeah, they just need to be found, and I kind of want to join in on this, because I have a couple stories that I think would be great for all ages.
That's great. You know, keep in touch. Let me know when all of this is, you know, going to hit.
And you can get the trivia books now on Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Okay, and what websites can people find you at so that they can look for your announcements and your other fun articles, like the people that you would cast for a DC movies and Marvel movies and things like that?
The Agent of Style column goes up at newsarama.com. I do several articles for them. I also am doing articles for Comic Book Resources, which is where you can find the casting choices for Marvel women movies and DC women movies. I'll also be putting up a couple other articles on there soon concerning gay superheroes and Action Comics, Grant Morrison's Action Comics. So look out for those. You can also find me on Twitter at Sizzler Kistler. And I do a weekly podcast with Jill Pantosi called Crazy Sexy Geeks. You can either find it on iTunes, or you can get to it by crazysexygeeks.libsyn.com. And an archive of my work is at alankistler.com.
Great. And, of course, you'll be able to find all of that out in the show notes here at amberunmasked.com. Alan, thanks so much for your time. I know that you've got you know, all of these million projects, so I have to let you go. Otherwise, I could easily talk to you all day.
Oh, it was fun.
So to follow me, of course, on Twitter, go to @ElizabethAmber. This is Amber Love from amberunmasked.com. Don't forget to go to audible.com/amberunmasked to get your free trial of audiobooks. And, of course, since we were talking about spy suits, go try out your very first martini. You can easily look up the 007 classic martini, which is vodka and vermouth. And so cheers. Thanks for listening, everyone.